and message. Capitol Building, January 6th, 1955.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, ladies and gentlemen of the Congress, my friends. First, I do most sincerely thank you from the bottom of my heart for the cordiality of your welcome. And I extend cordial greetings to the 84th Congress. We shall have much to do together. I'm sure that we shall get it done, and that we shall do it in harmony and goodwill. And here, I'm certain you would permit me this morning a personal allusion. The district where I was born has been represented in this Congress for more years than he cares to remember, I suppose, by our distinguished speaker. Today is his birthday, and I want to join with the rest of you in felicitating him and wishing him many happy birthday. Ladies and gentlemen, at the outset, I believe it would be well to remind ourselves of this great fundamental of our national life, our common belief that every human being is divinely endowed with dignity and with worth and inalienable rights. This faith, with its corollary, that to grow and flourish, people must be free, shapes the interests and the aspirations of every American. From this deep faith have evolved three main purposes of our federal government. First, to maintain justice and freedom among ourselves and to champion them for others so that we may work effectively for enduring peace. Second, to help keep our economy vigorous and expanding, thus sustaining our international strength and assuring better jobs, better living, better opportunities for every citizen. And third, to concern ourselves with the human problems of our people so that every American may have the opportunity to lead a healthy, productive, and rewarding life. It is under these three headings that I shall present to you today, ladies and gentlemen, the thoughts that I believe appropriate to this occasion. Now, foremost among these broad purposes of government is our support of freedom, justice, peace. It is of the utmost importance, then, that each of us understand the true nature of the world struggle now taking place. It is not a struggle merely of economic theories or of forms of government or of military power. The issue is the true nature of man. Either man is the creature whom the psalmist described as a little lower than the angels, crowned with glory and honor, holding dominion over the works of his creator, or man is a soulless, animated machine to be enslaved, used, and consumed by the state for its own glorification. It is therefore a struggle which goes to the roots of the human spirit, and its shadow falls across the long sweep of man's destiny. This prize, so precious, so fraught with ultimate meaning, is the true object of the contending forces in the world. In the past year, there has been progress justifying hope for the ultimate rule of freedom and justice in the world. Free nations are collectively stronger than at any time in recent years. Just as nations of this hemisphere, in the historic Caracas and Rio conferences, have closed ranks against imperialistic communism and strengthened their economic ties, so free nations elsewhere have forged new bonds of unity. Recent agreements between Turkey and Pakistan have laid a foundation for increased strength in the Middle East. With our understanding support, Egypt and Britain, Yugoslavia and Italy, Britain and Iran have resolved dangerous differences. The security of the Mediterranean has been enhanced by an alliance among Greece, Turkey, and Yugoslavia. Agreements in Western Europe have paved the way for unity to replace past divisions, which have undermined Europe's economic and military vitality. The defense of the West appears likely at last to include a free democratic Germany, participating as an equal in the councils of NATO. In Asia and the Pacific, the pending Manila Pact supplements our treaties with Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Korea, and Japan, and our prospective treaty with the Republic of China. These pacts stand as solemn warnings that future military aggression and subversion against the free nations of Asia will meet united response. The Pacific Charter, adopted at Manila, is a milestone in the development of human freedom and self-government in the Pacific area. Under the auspices of the United Nations, there is promise of progress in our country's plan for the peaceful use of atomic energy. Finally, today the world is at peace. It is, to be sure, an insecure peace. Yet all humanity finds hope in the simple fact that for an appreciable time, there has been no active battlefield on Earth. This same fact inspires us to work all the more effectively with other nations for the well-being, the freedom, the dignity of every human on Earth. In the ultimate achievement of this great purpose lies the only sure promise of security and permanent peace for any nation, including our own. These developments are heartening, but sober problems remain. The massive military machines and ambitions of the Soviet communist bloc still create uneasiness in the world. All of us are aware of the continuing reliance of the Soviet communists on military force, of the power of their weapons, of their present resistance to realistic armament limitations, and of their continuing effort to dominate or intimidate free nations on their periphery. Their steadily growing power includes an increasing strength in nuclear weapons. This power, combined with the proclaimed intentions of the communist leaders to communize the world, is the threat confronting us today. To protect our nations and our peoples from the catastrophe of a nuclear holocaust, free nations must maintain countervailing military power to persuade the communists of the futility of seeking to advance their ends through aggression. If communist rulers understand that America's response to aggression will be swift and decisive, that never shall we buy peace at the expense of honor or faith, they will be powerfully deterred from launching a military venture engulfing their own peoples and many others in disaster. Now this, of course, is a form of world stalemate. But in this stalemate, each of us, every American, may and must exercise his high duty to strive in every honorable way for enduring peace. The military threat is but one menace to our freedom and security. We must not only deter aggression, we must also frustrate the effort of communists to gain their goals by subversion. To this end, free nations must maintain and reinforce their cohesion, their internal security, their political and economic vitality, and their faith in freedom. In such a world, America's course is clear. We must strengthen the collective defense under the United Nations Charter and gird ourselves with sufficient military strength and productive capacity to discourage resort to war and protect our nation's vital interests. We must continue to support and strengthen the United Nations. At this moment, by vote of the United Nations General Assembly, its Secretary General is in Communist China on a mission of deepest concern to all Americans, seeking the release of our never-to-be-forgotten American aviators and all other United Nations prisoners. We must also encourage the efforts being made in the United Nations to limit armaments and to harness the atom to peaceful use. We must expand international trade and investment and assist friendly nations whose own best efforts are still insufficient to provide the strength essential to the security of the free world. We must be willing to use the processes of negotiation whenever they will advance the cause of just and secure peace. In respect to all these matters, we must, through a vigorous information program, keep the peoples of the world truthfully advised of our actions and purposes. This problem has been attacked with new vigor during the past months. I urge that the Congress give its earnest attention to the great advantages that can accrue to our country through the successful and expanded operations of this information program. We must carry forward our educational exchange program. Now, to advance these many efforts, the Congress must act in this session on appropriations, legislation, and treaties. Today, I shall mention especially our foreign, economic, and military programs. The recent economic progress in many free nations has been heartening. The productivity of labor and the production of goods and services are increasing in ever-widening areas. There is a growing will to improve the living standards of all men. This progress is important to all our people. It promises us allies who are strong and self-reliant. It promises a growing world market for the products of our mines, our factories, our farms. But only through steady effort can we continue this progress. Barriers still impede trade and the flow of capital needed to develop each nation's human and material resources. Wise reduction of these barriers is a long-term objective of our foreign economic policy, a policy of an evolutionary and selective nature, assuring broad benefits to our own and to other people. We must gradually reduce certain tariff obstacles to trade. These actions should, of course, be accomplished by a similar lowering of trade barriers by other nations, so that we may move steadily together toward economic advantage for all. We must further simplify our customs procedures. We must facilitate the flow of capital and continue technical assistance, both directly and through the United Nations. This must go to less developed countries to strengthen their independence and raise their living standards. Many another step must be taken in the free world to release forces of private initiative. On January 10th, by special message, I shall submit specific recommendations for carrying forward the legislative phases of our foreign economic policy. Our many efforts to build a better world include the maintenance of our military strength. This is a vast undertaking. Over 4 million Americans, servicemen and civilians, are on the rolls of the defense establishment. During the past 2 years, by attacking duplication and overstaffing, by improved procurement and inventory controls, by concentrating on the essentials, many billions of dollars have been saved in our defense activities. I should like to mention certain fundamentals underlying this vast program. First, I repeat that a realistic limitation of armament and an enduring just peace remain our national goals. We maintain powerful military forces because there is no present alternative. They are forces designed for deterrent and defensive purposes, able instantly to strike back with destructive power in response to any attack. Second, we must stay alert to the fact that undue reliance on one weapon or preparation for only one kind of warfare simply invites an enemy to resort to another. We must therefore keep in our armed forces balance and flexibility adequate to our needs. Third, to keep our armed forces abreast of the advances of science, our military planning must be flexible enough to utilize the new weapons and techniques which flow ever more speedily from our research and development programs. The forthcoming military budget therefore emphasizes modern air power in the Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps, and increases the emphasis on new weapons, especially those of rapid and destructive striking power. It seeks continuous modernization of our army. It accelerates the Continental Defense Program and the buildup of military reserve forces. It continues a vigorous program of stockpiling strategic materials and strengthening our mobilization base. It provides for reduction of forces in certain categories and their expansion in others to fit them to the military realities of our time. These emphases in our defense planning have been made at my personal direction after long and thoughtful, even prayerful study. In my judgment, they will give our nation a defense accurately adjusted to the national need. Fourth, pending a world agreement on armament limitation, we must continue to expand our supplies of nuclear weapons for our land, naval, and air forces. We shall continue our encouraging progress at the same time in the peaceful use of atomic power. Fifth, in the administration of these costly programs, we demand the utmost efficiency. We must assure our people not only of adequate protection, but also of a defense that can and will be resolutely carried forward from year to year until the threat of aggression has disappeared. To help maintain this kind of armed strength and to improve its efficiency, I urge the enactment of several important measures. The first concerns the Selective Service Act, which expires next June 30. For the foreseeable future, our standing forces must remain much larger than voluntary methods can sustain. We must therefore extend the statutory authority to induct men for 2 years of military service. The second kind of measure concerns the rapid turnover of our most experienced servicemen. This process seriously weakens the combat readiness of our armed forces and is unnecessarily and extravagantly expensive. To encourage more trained servicemen to remain in uniform, I shall, on the 13th of this month, propose a number of measures to increase the attractions of a military career. These measures will include more adequate medical care for dependents, survivors' benefits, more and better housing, and selective adjustments in military pay and allowance. And third, I shall present a program to rebuild and strengthen the civilian component of our armed forces, because it will go far in assuring fair and equitable participation in military service. It is of particular importance to our combat veterans. In keeping with our historic military policy, the program is designed to build civilian reserves capable of effective military service in an emergency, in lieu of maintaining active forces in excess of the nation's immediate need. Through this program, the individual will be able to discharge one of his obligations to the nation. Equally, the nation will be able to discharge one of its obligations to a potential future serviceman, namely, to give him the greatest possible chance of survival in time of war. Effective defense requires continuance of our aggressive attack on subversion at home. In this effort, we have, in the past 2 years, made real progress. FBI investigations have been reinforced by a new internal security division in the Department of Justice. The security activities of the Immigration and Naturalization Service have been revitalized. An improved security system is in effect throughout the government. The Department of Justice and the FBI have been armed with new legal weapons forged by the 83rd Congress. We shall continue to ferret out and to destroy communist subversion. We shall, in the process, carefully preserve our traditions and the basic rights of every American citizen. Our civil defense program is also a key element in the protection of our country. We are developing cooperative methods with state governors, mayors, and voluntary citizen groups in building the civil defense. The significance of this organization in time of war is obvious. Its swift assistance in disaster areas last year proved its importance in time of peace. An industry capable of rapid expansion and essential materials and facilities available in time of emergency are indispensable. I urge, therefore, a 2-year extension of the Defense Production Act and Title II of the First War Powers Act of 1941. These are cornerstones of our program for the development of an adequate mobilization base. At this point, I should like to make this additional observation. Our quest for peace and freedom necessarily presumes that we who hold positions of public trust must rise above self and section, that we must subordinate to the general good our partisan and our personal pride and prejudice. Tirelessly, with united purpose, we must fortify the material and spiritual foundations of this land of freedom. As never before, there is need for unhesitating cooperation among the branches of our government. At this time, the executive and legislative branches are under the management of different political parties. This fact places both parties on trial before the American people. In less perilous days of the past, division of governmental responsibility among our great parties has at times produced indecision approaching futility. We must not let this happen in our time. We must avoid a paralysis of the will for peace and international security. Now, in the traditionally bipartisan areas, military security and foreign relations, I can report to you that I have already, with the present leaders of this Congress, exchanged assurances of unreserved cooperation. Yet the security of our country requires more than maintenance of military strength and success in foreign affairs. These vital matters are in turn dependent upon concerted and vigorous action in a number of supporting programs. I say, therefore, to the 84th Congress, in all areas basic to the strength of America, there will be, to the extent I can assure them, cooperative, constructive relations between the executive and legislative branches of this government. Let the general good be our yardstick on every great issue of our time. In that pledge, I should include also the similar pledge of every head of department or independent agency in this government. Our efforts to defend our freedom and to secure a just peace are, of course, inseparable from the second great purpose of our government, to help maintain a strong, growing economy. An economy vigorous and free, in which there are ever-increasing opportunities, just rewards for effort, and a stable prosperity that is widely shared. In the past 2 years, many important governmental actions helped our economy adjust to conditions of peace. Controls were removed from wages, prices, and materials. Tax revisions encouraged increased private spending and employment. Federal expenditures were sharply reduced, making possible a record tax cut. These actions, together with flexible monetary and debt management policies, helped to halt inflation and stabilize the value of the dollar. A program of partnership in resource development was begun. Social security and unemployment insurance laws were broadened. New laws started the process of balancing farm production with farm markets. Shipbuilding and stockpiling programs strengthened key sectors of the economy while improving our mobilization base. A new housing law brought impressive progress in an area fundamental to our economic strength and closed loopholes in the old law that permitted dishonest manipulation. Many of these programs are just beginning to exert their stimulating effect upon the whole economy and upon specific communities and industries throughout the country. 1954 was one of the most prosperous years in our history. Business activity surges with new strength. Production is rising. Employment is high. Toward the end of last year, average weekly wages in manufacturing were higher than ever before. Personal income after taxes is at a record level. So is consumer spending. Construction activity is reaching new peaks. Export demand for our goods is strong. State and local government expenditures on public works are rising. Savings are high and credit is readily available. So today, the transition to a peacetime economy is largely behind us. The economic outlook is good. Now, the many promising factors I have mentioned do not guarantee sustained economic expansion. But they do give us a strong position from which to carry forward our economic growth. If we as a people act wisely, our annual national output can rise within a decade from its present level of about $360 billion to $500 billion, measured in dollars of stable buying power. The budget message on January 17th, the economic report on the 20th of the month, and several special messages will set forth in detail programs to foster the growth of our economy and to protect the integrity of the people's money. Today, I discuss these only in general terms. Government efficiency and economy remain essential to progress toward a balanced budget. More than $10 billion were cut from the spending program first proposed in the budget of January 9, 1953. So expenditures of that year were $6.5 billion below those of the previous year. In the current fiscal year, government spending will be nearly $4.5 billion less than in the fiscal year ending last June 30. New spending authority has been held below expenditures, reducing thus government obligations accumulated over the years. Last year, we had a large tax cut and for the first time in 75 years, a basic revision of tax law. It is now clear that defense and other essential government costs must remain at a level precluding further tax reductions this year. Although excise and corporation income taxes must, therefore, be continued at their present rates, further tax cuts will be possible when justified by lower expenditures and by revenue increases arising from the nation's economic growth. I am hopeful that such reductions can be made next year. At the foundation of our economic growth are the raw materials and energy produced from our minerals and fuels, lands and forests, and water resources. With respect to them, I believe that the nation must adhere to three fundamental policies. First, to develop, wisely use, and to conserve basic resources from generation to generation. Second, to follow the historic pattern of developing these resources, primarily by private citizens, under fair provisions of law, including restraints for proper conservation. And third, to treat resource development as a partnership undertaking. A partnership in which the participation of private citizens and state and local governments is as necessary as is federal participation. This policy has encouraged local public bodies and private citizens to plan their own power sources. Increasing numbers of applications to the Federal Power Commission to conduct surveys and prepare plans for power development are evidence of local response. The federal government and local and private organizations have been encouraged to coordinate their development. This is important because federal hydroelectric developments supply but a very small fraction of the nation's power needs. Such partnership projects as Priest Rapids in Washington, the Coosa River development in Alabama, the Markham Ferry in Oklahoma already have the approval of this Congress. This year, justifiable projects of a similar nature will again have administration support. Now, of course, the federal government must shoulder its own partnership obligations by undertaking projects of such complexity and size that their success requires federal development. In keeping with this principle, I again urge the Congress to approve the development of the upper Colorado River Basin to conserve and assure better use of precious water essential to the future of the West. In addition, the 1956 budget will recommend appropriations to start 6 new reclamation projects and more than 30 new Corps of Engineer projects of varying size. Going projects and investigations of potential new resource developments will be, of course, continued. A great need in this broad field is a nationwide comprehensive water resources policy firmly based in law. Such a policy is under preparation and when completed, will be submitted to the Congress for its consideration. Continued vigilance will be maintained over our fisheries, wildlife resources, the national parks and forests, and the public land. And we shall continue to encourage an orderly development of the nation's mineral resources. A modern highway system is essential to meet the needs of our growing population, our expanding economy, and our national security. We are accelerating our highway improvement program under existing state and federal laws and authorizations. But this effort will not, in itself, assure our people of an adequate system. This problem has been carefully considered by the Conference of State Governors and by a special advisory committee on a national highway program composed of leading private citizens. I have received the recommendations of the Governor's Conference and will shortly receive the views of the special committee. Aided by their findings, I plan to submit on January 27th recommendations which will meet our most pressing national highway needs. In further recognition of the importance of transportation to our economic strength and security, the administration, through a cabinet committee, is thoroughly examining existing federal transportation policies to determine their effect on the adequacy of transportation services. This is the first such comprehensive review ever undertaken directly by the executive branch of the government in modern times. We are not only examining major problems facing the various modes of transport, we are also studying closely the interrelationships of civilian and government requirements for transportation. Legislation will be recommended to correct such policy deficiencies as we find. The nation's public works activities are tremendous in scope. It is estimated that more than $12 billion will be expended in 1955 for the development of land, water, and other resources, control of floods, navigation and harbor improvements, construction of roads, schools, and municipal water supplies, and disposal of domestic and industrial waste. Many of the federal, state, and local agencies responsible for this work are highly efficient. But public works activities are closely interrelated and have a substantial influence on the growth of the country. Moreover, in times of threatening economic contraction, they may become a valuable sustaining force. Efficient planning and execution of the nation's public works require the coordination of federal activities and effective cooperation with state and local governments. The Council of Economic Advisors, through its Public Works Planning Section, has made important advances during the past year in effecting this coordination and cooperation. To give more emphasis and continuity to this essential coordination, I shall request the Congress to appropriate funds for the support of an Office of Coordinator of Public Works in the Executive Office of the President. Now, a most significant element in our growing economy is an agriculture that is stable, prosperous, and free. The problems of our agriculture have evolved over many years and cannot be solved overnight. Nevertheless, governmental actions last year hold great promise of fostering a better balance between production and market, and consequently, a better and more stable income for farmers. Through vigorous administration and new authority provided by the 83rd Congress, surplus farm products are now moving into consumption. From February 1953 through November 1954, the rate of increase in government-held surpluses has been greatly reduced by our moving into use more than $2.3 billion worth of government-owned farm commodities. Domestic consumption remains high, and farm exports will be higher than last year. As a result of the flexibility provided by the Agricultural Act of 1954, we can move toward less restrictive acreage control. Thus, farm production is gradually adjusting to markets. Markets are being expanded, and stocks are moving into use. We can now look forward to an easing of the influences depressing farm prices, to reduced government expenditures for purchase of surplus products, and to less federal intrusion into the lives and plans of our farm people. Agricultural programs have been redirected toward better balance, greater stability, and sustained prosperity. We are headed in the right direction. I urgently recommend to the Congress that we continue resolutely on this road. greater attention must be directed to the needs of low-income farm families. 28% of our farm operator families have net cash incomes of less than $1,000 per year. I shall later submit recommendations designed to assure the steady alleviation of their most pressing concerns. Because drought also remains a serious agricultural problem, I shall recommend legislation to strengthen federal disaster assistance programs. This legislation will seek an improved appraisal of need, better adjustment of the various programs to local conditions, and a more equitable sharing of costs between the states and the federal government. The prosperity of our small business enterprises is an indispensable element in the maintenance of our economic strength. Creation of the Small Business Administration and tax laws facilitating small business expansion are but two of the many steps the government has taken to encourage smaller enterprises. I recommend that the Congress extend the Small Business Act of 1953, now due to expire next June. We come now to the third great purpose of our government, its concern for the health, productivity, and well-being of all our people. Every citizen wants to give a full expression to his God-given talents and abilities and to have the recognition and respect accorded under our great traditions. Americans want a good standard of living, not simply to accumulate possessions, but to fulfill a legitimate aspiration for an environment in which their families may live meaningful and happy lives. Our people are committed, therefore, to the creation and preservation of opportunities for every citizen, opportunity to lead a more rewarding life. They are equally committed to the alleviation of unavoidable misfortune and distress among their fellow citizens. The aspirations of most of our people can best be fulfilled through their own enterprise and initiative without government interference. This administration, therefore, follows two simple rules. First, the federal government should perform an essential task in this field only when it cannot otherwise be adequately performed. And second, in performing that task, our government must not impair the self-respect, the freedom, and the incentive of the individual. So long as these two rules are observed, the government can and must fully meet its obligations without creating a dependent population or a domineering bureaucracy. During the past 2 years, notable advances were made in these functions of government. Protection of old age and survivors insurance was extended to an additional 10 million of our people by action of Congress. Legislation was enacted to provide unemployment insurance protection to some 4 million additional Americans. Stabilization of living costs and the halting of inflation protected the value of pensions and savings. A broad program now helps to bring good homes within the reach of the great majority of our people. With the state, we are providing more clinics, hospitals, and nursing homes for patients with chronic illnesses. Also with the state, we have begun a fruitful expansion in the restoration of disabled persons to employment and to useful lives. In the areas of federal responsibility, we have made historic progress in eliminating from among our people demeaning practices based on race or color. All of us may be proud of these achievements, yet essential federal tasks remain to be done. As part of our efforts to provide decent, safe, and sanitary housing for low-income families, we must carry forward the housing program authorized during the past Congress. We must also authorize contracts for a firm program of 35,000 additional public housing units in each of the next two fiscal years. This program will meet the most pressing obligations of the federal government into the 1958 fiscal year for planning and building public housing. By that time, the private building industry, aided by the Housing Act of 1954, will have had the opportunity to assume its full role in providing adequate housing for low-income families. The health of our people is one of our most precious assets. Knowledge available to combat disease and disability should be fully used. Otherwise, we as a people are guilty not only of neglected human suffering, but also of wasting our national strength. Advances in medical care are not available to enough of our citizens. Our nation must do more to reduce the impact of accidents and disease. Two fundamental problems confront us. First, high and ever-rising costs of health services. Second, serious gaps and shortages in those services. By special message of January 24, I shall propose a coordinated program to strengthen and improve existing health services. This program will continue to reject socialized medicine. It will emphasize individual and local responsibility. Under it, the federal government will neither dominate nor direct, but it will serve as a helpful partner. The recommendations will include a federal health reinsurance service to encourage the development of better voluntary health insurance coverage by private organizations. I shall recommend measures to improve the medical care of that group of our citizens who, because of need, receive federal, state, public assistance. To reduce the gaps in medical service, I shall propose new measures to facilitate construction of needed health facilities and help reduce shortages of trained health personnel. Vigorous steps to combat the misery and national loss involved in mental illness. Improved services for crippled children and for maternal and child health. Better consumer protection under our existing pure food and drug laws. And finally, strengthen programs to combat the increasingly serious pollution of our rivers and streams and the growing problems of air pollution. Last year's expansion of Social Security coverage and the new program of improved medical care for public assistance recipients together suggest modification of the formula for federal sharing in old age assistance payments. I recommend modification of the formula where such payments will, in the future, supplement benefits received under the old age and survivors insurance system. It is the right of every American from childhood on to have access to knowledge. The education of all our citizens is therefore imperative to the maintenance and invigoration of America's free institutions. Today, we face grave educational problems. Up-to-date analyses of these problems and their solutions are being carried forward through the individual state conferences and the White House conferences to be completed this year. However, such factors as population growth, additional responsibility of schools, and increased and longer school attendance have produced an unprecedented classroom shortage. This shortage is of immediate concern to all our people. Affirmative action must be taken now. Without impairing in any way the responsibilities of our state, our localities, communities, or families, the federal government should serve as an effective agent in dealing with this problem. I shall forward a special message to the Congress on February 15th, presenting a program dealing with this shortage. To help the states do a better job, we must strengthen their resources for preventing and dealing with juvenile delinquency. I shall propose federal legislation to assist the states in dealing with this nationwide problem. We shall carry forward the vigorous efforts of the administration to improve the international control of traffic in narcotics, and in cooperation with state and local agencies to combat narcotic addiction in our own country. I should like to speak to you now of additional matters of importance to all our people, and especially to our wage earners. During the past year, certain industrial changes and the readjustment of the economy conditions of peace brought unemployment and other difficulties to various localities and industries. These problems are engaging our most earnest attention. But for the overwhelming majority of our working people, the past year has meant good jobs. Moreover, the earnings and savings of our wage earners are no longer depreciating in value. Because of cooperative relationships between labor and management, fewer working days were lost through strikes in 1954 than in any year in the past decade. The outlook for our wage earners can be made still more promising by several legislative actions. First, in the past 5 years, we have had economic growth which will support an increase in the federal minimum wage. In the light of present economic conditions, I recommend its increase to 90 cents an hour. I also recommend that many others, at present excluded, be given the protection of a minimum wage. Second, I renew my recommendation of last year for amendment of the Labor-Management Relations Act of 1947 to further the basic objectives of that statute. I especially call to the attention of the Congress amendments dealing with the right of economic strikers to vote in representation elections and the need for equalizing the obligation under the Act to file disclaimers of communist affiliation. Third, the administration will propose other important measures, including occupational safety, workmen's compensation for longshoremen and harbor workers, and the 8-hour laws applicable to federal contractors. Legislation will also be proposed respecting non-occupational disability insurance and unemployment compensation in the District of Columbia. On January 11th, I shall propose a pay adjustment plan for civilian employees outside of the Postal Field Service to correct inequities and increase individual pay rates. I shall also recommend voluntary health insurance on a contributory basis for federal employees and their dependents. In keeping with the Group Life Insurance Act passed in the 83rd Congress, this protection should be provided on the group insurance principle and purchased from private facilities. Also, on January 11th, I shall recommend a modern pay plan, including pay increases for postal field employees. As part of this program and to carry forward our progress toward elimination of the large annual postal deficit, I shall renew my request for an increase in postal rates. Again, I urge that in the future, the fixing of rates be delegated to an impartial, independent body. Needed improvements in survivor, disability, and retirement benefits for federal personnel have been extensively considered by an appropriate committee. The committee's proposals would strengthen and improve benefits for our career people in government. I endorse their broad objectives. Full contributory coverage under old age and survivor's insurance should be made available to all federal personnel, just as in private industry. For career military personnel, the protection of the old age and survivor's insurance system would be an important and long-needed addition, especially to their present unequal and inadequate survivorship protection. The military retirement pay system should remain separate and unchanged. Certain adjustments in the present civilian personnel retirement systems will be needed. However, these systems also are a basic part of a total compensation and should be separately and independently retained. I also urge the Congress to approve a long overdue increase in the salaries of members of Congress and of the federal judiciary. And in my opinion, this raise should be substantial because I believe it should be to a level commensurate with their heavy responsibilities. Our concern for the individual in our country requires that we consider several additional problems. We must continue the program to help our Indian citizens improve their lives and make their full contribution to national life. 2 years ago, I advised the Congress of injustices under existing immigration laws. Through humane administration, the Department of Justice is doing what it legally can to alleviate hardship. Clearance of aliens before arrival has been initiated, and except for criminal offenders, the imprisonment of aliens awaiting admission or deportation has been stopped. Certain provisions of law, however, have the effect of compelling action in respect to aliens, which are inequitable in some instances and discriminatory in others. These provisions should be corrected in this session of the Congress. As the complex problems of Alaska are resolved, that territory should be expected to achieve status. In the meantime, there is no justification for deferring the admission to status of Hawaii. I again urge approval of this measure. We have three splendid opportunities to demonstrate the strength of our belief in the right of suffrage. First, I again urge that a constitutional amendment be submitted to the state to reduce the voting age for federal elections. Second, I renew my request that the principle of self-government be extended and the right of suffrage granted to the citizens of the District of Columbia. Third, I again recommend that we work with the state to preserve the voting rights of citizens in the nation's services overseas. In our determination to keep faith with those who in the past have met the highest call of citizenship, we now have understudied the system of benefits for veterans and for surviving dependents of deceased veterans and servicemen. Studies will be undertaken to determine the need for measures to ease the readjustment to civilian life of men required to enter the armed forces for 2 years of service. In the advancement of the various activities which will make our civilization endure and flourish, the federal government should do more to give official recognition to the importance of the arts and other cultural activities. I shall recommend the establishment of a federal advisory commission on the arts within the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to advise the federal government on ways to encourage artistic and cultural endeavor and appreciation. I shall also propose that awards of merit be established whereby we can honor our fellow citizens who make great contributions to the advancement of our civilization and of this country. Every citizen rightly expects efficient and economical administration of these many governmental programs I have outlined today. I strongly recommend extension of the Reorganization Act and the law establishing the Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, both of which expire this spring. Thus, the Congress will assure continuation of the excellent progress recently made in improving government organization and administration. In this connection, we are looking forward with great interest to the report, which will soon be going to the Congress from the Commission on Organization of the Executive Branch of the Government. I'm sure that these studies, made under the chairmanship of former President Herbert Hoover, with the assistance of more than 200 distinguished citizens, will be of great value in paving the way toward more efficiency and economy in the government. And now, I return to the point at which I began, the faith of our people. The many programs here summarized are, I believe, in full keeping with their needs, interests, and aspirations. The obligations upon us are clear: to labor earnestly, patiently, prayerfully, for peace, for freedom, for justice, throughout the world, to keep our economy vigorous and free that our people may lead fuller, happier lives, to advance, not merely by our words, but by our acts, the determination of our government that every citizen shall have opportunity to develop to his fullest capacity. As we do these things, before us is a future filled with opportunity and with hope. That future will be ours if, in our time, we keep alive the patience, the courage, the confidence in tomorrow, the deep faith of the millions who in years past made and preserved us this nation. A decade ago, in the death and desolation of America, of European battlefields, I saw the courage and resolution. I felt the inspiration of American youth. In these young men, I felt America's buoyant confidence and irresistible will to do. In them, I saw, too, a devout America, humble before God. And so I know in my heart, and I believe that all Americans know, that despite the anxieties of this divided world, our faith and the cause in which we all believe will surely prevail. And now, my friends, my apologies for the length of this address, and thank you for your great courtesy.